From a crowded hotel room on Mason Street in San Francisco, California, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game Devs talk games and game development.
I'm Dale LaCroix, and I make Nice Games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make Nice Games.
And I'm Arthur Croy. I, too, make Nice Games. This week, we're out west at the 2024 Game Developers Conference. We'll be recapping and discussing some of what we've seen and done during our time here at the show. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. So, we're not alone.
Yeah.
It's not just the three of us.
Creepy.
Two regular hosts, one guest host. We also have Max with us.
You.
Max, say some words.
Hi, I'm Max, and I also make Nice Games.
Listeners will know Max as our guest booker.
So we've been at GDC.
It's Monday.
One day.
Yes.
I'm exhausted.
It's Monday night as we record this.
Yes.
We'll recount a little bit of what happened yesterday as we registered and went to an event. And then we'll talk about what we did today. And then we're going to stop recording night. And then we're going to record every night of the week. So you, listener, will hear us start and stop the microphone and recount as best we can.
Yeah. It'll be nice because I won't have to remember this. I can forget everything I did the day before.
But also, we've already recorded some other content.
Yes.
Some interviews. And whatever else we get during the week will be spliced along with it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Some decisions are going to be left for Mark for next week.
Yeah.
To decide how this thing is put together.
Good luck, Feature Mark.
Yep. But a little bit behind the curtain.
Feature Mark splicing in just to let you know that is not how it went. You'll find out.
But why don't we start talking about what we did on Sunday?
Sure.
We wanted to get in early.
Yeah.
Earlier than Monday, because like the line to get your badge on Monday
is
like historically a nightmare.
Yes.
Now, this year at GDC, we've talked in past episodes about the COVID protocols.
Yeah.
Because they came back 2 years ago, was the first year back after a couple of years virtual. And they had a kind of a not well designed system to confirm everybody's vaccination status.
Yeah.
Now this year they've dropped all that because they can't be bothered anymore, I guess.
Yep.
And so things supposedly would go a lot faster. We had a different experience for a couple of reasons, but ultimately we didn't know all of that when we made our plans.
Yes.
We wanted to get in on Sunday because they do a little bit of a pre. You can pick up your badge a little bit earlier. And yeah, we thought it'd be earlier in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. So we kind of we made some plans for Nice Games Club stuff. But outside of that, we kind of just waited around for several hours.
It's weird when you're not on vacation.
Yeah.
Because, like, you have nothing to do.
Yeah.
I think you guys are just bad at traveling.
Yeah.
I mean, fair. It's probably accurate.
We could have gone to the pier and saw the seals or whatever. But
yeah.
I got to spend the morning on Sunday. I went to the Musée Mécanique.
Oh, right. Yeah, you did.
You said I pronounced it correctly.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
You play the weirdest, oldest things ever made.
Did you play the game where you crank the thing and you race somebody?
That is all of the game.
Well, I was very good at that.
Cool.
When we played it six or seven years ago, because Mark said, quote, "You don't care if you break it."
Yeah, I think that's the secret to having fun. Because otherwise, you're just like, this thing is 100 years old. I'm a little nervous. If there are people watching, they don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. So that's cool. So you had a more exciting time than we did, Max, I think.
Great.
We went to get our tickets, and it was nice because, like, this year, we didn't have to wait in line. I felt, like, a little weird about it, but, like, we didn't have to wait in line because we were pressed. So we just, like, walked into the press room, and they gave us our badges basically right away.
Yeah, but even still, the attendee line wasn't very long at that time.
And that's true, too.
Even on Sunday, the line gets long.
Yes.
But this year, I think it's because they dropped a lot of the rigmarole.
Yeah.
It wasn't so bad. But yeah, we just went right to the press room.
Yeah.
Got our stuff, got our meal vouchers, which is, that's the secret, folks, to get the press badge, is they give you concession money.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh boy, that's nice.
It is.
I mean, when it runs out on Wednesday morning, we're going to be like, oh, I didn't give us enough.
Yeah.
But still, you know, free snack money. You can't complain.
That's pretty nice. We did drop the ball on that. Dale has gotten a GDC pass this year.
Yeah.
And is able to go into talks.
I got to go to some talks this morning.
Yes.
Before that, Sunday night, we went to an event called Day of the Devs, where they crammed like a million of the safe TV in a building that's made for events.
Yep.
And then let people play it.
A million of the same TV. I think what you mean to say is there were 50 games on show, and they all had very similar setups.
Yeah.
It wasn't one. Okay. Continue.
The way I tell it is more entertaining.
Sure. Nicegames.club/feedback.
It was kind of a mess, but I played some good games.
Cool.
Yeah.
And Steven got some interview there, so you'll hear it here.
Oh, psych. It's Future Mark here again. That interview and a couple other bonus things we did during the week, it's actually going to go up on the Patreon. That's our little sneaky incentive for you. Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub. You can hear that bonus content from this week, as well as, you know, of course, all the other great bonus content that's on there. All right, I'll shut up. Back to the show.
But I did get an interview with, I went immediately to the fighting games. Of course I did.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to somebody there. It was cool. Mm-hmm. It's a game called Two Strikes. But that was a fun game. Max, you played a game that was like your aesthetic.
Yes. Dreams Elsewhere.
Yeah. Which I had heard of before.
It's got this aesthetic that's like Undertale meets Persona 5.
Yeah.
And I love anything that just has high contrast visuals. So I love this. And I also crashed the game.
Right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, so, I was walking around and I walked right up to you.
As soon as you walked
just
up,
as you crashed the game.
Oh, no.
And you were like, it's fine. I'm like, what's going on here?
I'm like, oh, are they doing something subversive? No. I hit F5, restarted it.
Oh, dang.
That's wild. It was good otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
Did
okay.
You play any games in mind? I played a couple of things. I couldn't really. Maybe it's the environment. It's like a warehouse with dim and it's like kind of smoky, even though you wouldn't expect it to be.
And
lots of bodies and lots of loud music, and it's just like not my environment. So I was like, I'm just gonna be the observer. So I watched a lot of the games, and I kind of got a sense of, I tried to remember a lot of the names so I can look them up later.
Sure.
But I didn't really play much.
That's fair.
You played the one frog mountain climbing game.
Yeah,
the controller to me. And then I was enthralled by it.
Yeah, you really liked it.
Alley Peaks.
I really didn't like it.
I could tell.
I had nothing but complaints about the control scheme. And it's like,
no, as soon as I picked it up, it's like, no, I get it.
Yep,
it's weird. It doesn't make sense, but I get why it's weird.
Yeah. Well, but also, they didn't have Y inverts, so that it can go straight to hell. I mean, that's a complaint one.
That could just be the demo.
But a really, really charming art style. Sure. I really wanted to like it, but I think it was maybe too speedrunner friendly for me. It's a sort of first person rock climbing game with a really interesting, the climbing mechanic is really fascinating and really interesting and clever.
Yeah.
But as I was playing it, I mean, Y invert aside, I was thinking like, oh, this is designed for optimization, not for enjoyment.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
In a way that like, so I could see why a lot of people would like it. And watching Max play and like seeing someone who like totally like clicked with it, I'm like, oh, this game's going to do fine. Like it has an audience, whatever.
Yeah.
Like it's not a problem. It's not broken.
Yeah.
But like for me, it just bounced.
It just doesn't work.
I played it for a bit. I stuck with it because I wanted to like, because it had a lot going for it. But I think.
It's very charming.
Yeah. I think in a non-controlled environment, I would have bounced immediately, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough.
Mm. So that was our Sunday. We played a bunch of games.
Well, Dale, there's two games you played a lot of.
Oh, yeah.
I want you to talk about.
I played one game that was a search and find game. Give me the, what's it called?
It was called Some Traveling Lady.
Okay, I looked this one up. My guess was close. It's Sophia the Traveler.
Anyway, it was a search for things.
Kind of a Where's Waldo. Kind of.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. And like the problem is of those million TVs they got, they're too big because you can't see the whole screen at the same time.
It's like sitting too close at the IMAX.
Yeah.
They were all like that. So yeah, there's 50-inch TVs.
I was looking for. I was just clicking on everything.
Sure.
But you know what I liked about that game? It had lots of cats.
Yep.
Okay. Number two, I played a game that was about like botany and stuff, and then it was first person look around, and then I got motion sick. I was like, why do I suddenly feel nauseous? And then I stopped playing.
Yeah.
And then I played a third game, and that was about an old man. It was called Herman and a Pig.
Oh, yeah.
Herman and the Pig.
Mm-hmm. That's what
it was about finding mushrooms.
Yeah, so that was our Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
We did Monday stuff. Oh, Dale's ready.
Okay. No, I'm gonna guide this. We're gonna go fast.
All right,
okay, ready? Okay, so Monday. Okay, Steven, tell us all the talks you attended.
Oh, I went to all the talks you went to. So just you can recount them because you took.
Okay, Steven, Fallout the board game talk. Yep. What should be different and what should be the same?
Yep. Oh, that I have complained about that talk, but you should go first.
Listener, just gird yourself.
Yeah.
Second, we went to Chinese board game market. lessons learned over the past 15 years.
Yep. Those are the only two talks I went to Denmark today.
Third.
Wait, let's hear this complaint.
Oh, all right. Okay. So basically the...
This is not the style. Okay.
Sorry. Okay. Real quick. That basically the dude at the whole game had a Goldilocks complex going on where things needed to be, were not too much, but not too little. And that was basically the whole talk. It was kind of annoying. there were some interesting insights to it though. I think that like, they were talking about like how they designed, some of the roles for like different, this, you know, special and Fallout,
yeah,
all the different stats you can have, how they designed those, the die for that specifically, I thought was pretty cool. There was some kind of like insights in respect to that and stuff that,
mm-hmm,
but I just got kind of frustrated because sometimes it was just be like, well, you can't have too much Fallout because blah, 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 but you can't have too little Fallout because blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. And it was just like 30 minutes of that.
Yeah.
So
high tip, do have the right amount of the thing.
Yeah. I'm like, that's not helpful at all.
Yeah.
Okay. Continue, Dale. Sorry.
Okay. Okay, we're going talk by talk.
Yep.
It was fine. Talk number two. Chinese board game market.
Yeah.
Lessons learned over the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. Steven, what was your favorite fact from it?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember the facts. I just remember I think the whole narrative that they talked about, like, with respect to how China has changed, like, the board game scene has changed a bunch. I guess actually is what I did that I thought was interesting about it is like their board game venues. They look like ours, but they also have like a private room for board games. That was kind of interesting where people would just like rent out a room and it would just be them playing in a board game as though it was like a karaoke room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Karaoke room. Or something.
It's the Asian version, just like karaoke.
Sure.
Americans, we expect you to get up in front of everybody and sing really badly.
That's true. That's true.
Okay, what I thought was interesting about it is that they kind of said that, you know, 15 years ago, the main people playing board games were university students who had traveled abroad and then brought them back and then taught people by, you know, explaining the rules in Chinese and translating them.
Yeah.
And that market has really grown over the years because now they can buy things directly thanks to, you know, companies importing them directly into China, making copies, and then also because like just the market has expanded and there's actual board game stores and things are sold over the internet now.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that I found what was interesting from that, whereas, you know, like you and I probably grew up playing Don't Break the Ice and Goodies and things like that, not really the same in Chinese families.
Yeah.
They kind of said, you know, it would be something that a teacher brings out to, you know, teach a lesson is the game.
Yep, yep.
But not really that same play a game with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Even though, you know, obviously Chinese have had games for a long time.
Yeah.
Like I'm thinking of Mahjong.
Mm-hmm.
Like obviously a game, but not like the same kind of modern themed board game.
Yeah.
The things that I learned, the takeaways that I had from it is, number one, to be successful with your board game in China, first be successful with your board game elsewhere. So get a really great,
another really good hot tip.
Great board game geek ranking because they pay attention to that.
Yeah.
Tip number two, get a accurate translation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we make fun of Chinese menus for saying weird things, they have the same problem.
Sure. Well, that's video game localization has been suffering the same kind of thing. Like, people are just not caring enough. Yeah.
Yep. Along with that, not just localizing the translating it, but like they gave the example of Patchwork, where they changed the shape of the buttons to reflect a traditional Chinese jade button that would be handed down through generations rather than like our, you know, plastic four hole or two hole button.
Yeah, that was actually really fascinating because like their box designs, their visuals were drastically different for Chinese audiences than they were for American audiences and for European audiences too. They built it differently for each depending on where they was going. So
yeah,
it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, the other thing that I thought was helpful is that they suggested building on like a known cultural thing. So they used a lot of examples from TV shows and books from China They're like, you know, the theming just goes so people know what it is. For us, they said, you know, werewolves are great because we have things like The Vampire Diaries and Harry Potter, and so everybody knows what a werewolf is. So, like, you don't have to explain those concepts with it. So using existing cultural to draw from. And then, what else? Then there was a game I really wanted to play called Gossip Goose.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is a combination between Telephone and Guess Who.
Yeah, it also seemed like it had some kind of social deduction thing going on, but they didn't explain the game really, so.
Yeah, yeah, but it looked fun. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Looked cute anyway.
Yeah, but like they explained that there's more interest in kind of like protecting copyright because I think that they were hit with some, you know, pirated or copied games where it just the quality disappeared, and so there's some renewed interest in that in China. Okay, I went to a talk called Non-Binary by the Design. It had lots of good tips for being a non-binary or otherwise queer person games.
You didn't make it in.
Yeah.
So one thing that was interesting about that, I was signed up to go to that talk too, but the line was extremely long. And I made it there fairly late. So, like, they closed the doors and the line was still, like, there was still at least 50 people, like, just waiting to get in. Mm-hmm. So, like, I wasn't able to go to the talk. But, like, it's cool to see that, like, it was so widely wanting to be attended.
Yeah. And it was really interesting. Like, a lot of the same kind of advice applies that, like, they usually give to women about, like, you know, getting an ally who will say something like, I really like Dale's idea.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And then also getting everybody in on your particular, like, project to make a non-binary-themed character or whatever. So that, like, if something were to fail, it isn't seen as, like, your failure, your thing.
Sure.
It's a group effort.
Yeah.
So it's not connected so closely to you and counted against you in the way that those things can with minority groups.
Cool.
Number whatever I went to, Finnish Game Jams with a woman who talked about all the crazy game jams they do in Finland, which started with her doing global game jams, but now they have like a specific Finnish game jam. They do quantum game jams with quantum computers. She went on train jam. She'd really love that. So okay. Then they had a bus jam.
Cool.
They had a jam bike, which is a game jam on a tandem bicycle.
What?
Yeah, like they had a specialized computer for the guy in the back because that person does not have to steer.
Yeah.
When, like, your front pedaler.
Yeah.
To code.
That's wild.
Yeah. And then they did that on the way to another game event.
Sure.
And then they had a Sammy Jam and a Sami Jam, but that's better.
Yeah. Okay.
It is not about sandwiches. It is about the Sami people. She talked about it a little and about getting, you know, the native people involved in it, but like also like how it emotionally hit her where she wasn't really expecting it to in that way.
Yeah.
And then something called Jam Jam, which is essentially they went to a ski resort in the summertime and then sat in the sauna in the hot tub a lot.
All right, sure.
Okay. There's a lot of sauna talk in it. Yeah, anyway. Yeah. Okay. Number whatever we're on. Okay. Mass Market Tabletop Design about Without Fail by the Exploding Kittens people.
I went to this with you.
Yes. Okay. What was your number one takeaway from that?
They talked a lot about the production process because the game Without Fail is it has 150 mini games in it.
Mm.
So they talked a little bit about like production realities of that, and they focused on accessibility and inclusiveness with the design, and all of that was great. But my actual takeaway was a thing they said, which is that they're like, oh, we put out a call to the whole company to come to brainstorm ideas for these mini games. They're kind of tasks in the tradition of Taskmaster,
okay.
Which they cited. Cool. And Dale and I like elbowed each other, like, we know what they're talking about. And listeners have heard us talk on the show before about also do.
Yeah.
But they ended up with 292 ideas, which they whittled down. But what they said was, and we just needed to actually figure it out. So we spent two whole days playtesting it, or two full days, they described it. We were thinking in that moment, like, that's not a lot of time.
Yeah.
But it was presented a lot of time. And I think what the actual takeaway I have from that is something unrelated to the talk, just a thought I had.
Sure.
Which is that we talk a lot about like data collection and playtesting and how vital and important that is.
Yes.
And iteration.
Yes.
But at the same time, and I think I have said this on the show before, but I think it is also important. Like sometimes you just test a thing once to see if it works, mm-hmm. and then you need the confidence to know that it works.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy when you do, you know, kneel at the altar of playtesting to start thinking that like you don't have enough information when you just had two people play it and not enough types of people play it. And like sometimes you do have to trust yourself as a designer. And so when they said that they really just tested them to see if they would work. They didn't actually, I mean, they had a whole playtesting process,
right.
But like they could start whittling down and finessing without having to like rigorously test all 292.
Sure.
They just needed to run them through the paces to check to see if they were not crazy or not. And so it was interesting because they described it as two full days. Like it was a lot of time.
Yeah.
And it just didn't seem like a lot of time for that much playtesting.
Yeah.
But then I'm thinking it through that lens, like, oh, really? That's not what it meant. Like that's just about. And so, yeah, it's. Unfortunately, Stephen, it's you don't want too much of a thing and you don't want too little of a thing.
No!
I'm sorry, that is the message.
Well, I had a different takeaway from that where they got the whole company to like brainstorm those 250 or so. And I was like, I could have come up with 250 in 2 days.
Yeah, I did like that too. I think one of the things when you are a creative professional, you start thinking about like you're the only one qualified to do the thing you're hired to do.
Yeah.
When it realized like the whole thing about being a creative professional is the only thing that makes you different is the professional part. Right. It doesn't make you more creative. And so I do enjoy like that the company cultures that involve just like, yeah, like everyone can brainstorm because it's like not you don't have to be precious about the discipline of creativity.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
The other thing that I took away from that is that when they went into the actual like longer playtesting process where they had people outside the company doing it, they would send them the components and have them playtest and video record in their own home because they felt it was important to have people playtest in the environment that they would actually be playing. And I thought that was interesting because that's something that we don't generally do because it's not as
accessible
financially to do that when you are a very small, you know, team or solo dev.
Sure.
Yeah, there's a lot of tabletop simulator. There's a lot of abstracted to try to, but I get, they had the resources to do it, but you could see the value of that, of like actual, the things you don't, the variables you can't control for, you know.
Yeah.
Then I went to Calico, the game Postmortem, which I loved because it was about cats. But this is also something where I have been following this woman in this game for a while and retreating their stuff, you know, naturally, because it's about
cats.
And her message was not, you need a middle ground. It was essentially, know what you do well and know what your audience wants.
Yeah.
And lean into it and don't care about other people.
That's cool.
This is a very like stylized, it's not like a polished games.
Sure.
It's very silly. You can make a cat giant and then ride around on it. You can put a cat on your head and it's cat hat. You can put another cat on top of that and it's a cat hat.
That's great.
Anyway, so I thought that was a interesting, different thing. And then the thing that she said was like to find out what people were interested in. I would post things on Twitter, and that's where I had found her before, posting things on Twitter. And you realize people really reacted to the silly things. And like, and now that Twitter is not Twitter anymore, she said like the most valuable part of it was, you know, the video or the GIF aspect of it. And so she kind of leaned toward, you know, if we're not going to, you know, Twitter is its own thing now. But like Thich Nhat might be the next place to kind of get that kind of feedback, just because it sports that kind of video.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Dale went to a lot of talks, y'all.
Well, it's my first time.
That's fair. That's
true. And I like facts about things.
That's true.
Okay. The last talk I went to was UX and UI design for tabletop. I knew most of this because we've done tabletop things. Mm-hmm. What do I want to say about it? This is worth revisiting because the just kind of, he kind of talked about like ways to reduce cost of your game, but like also think how to think about what's important. Things that I thought were interesting is they divided things into 6 physical zones of play. So like what your dominant hand is doing, and it's usually holding a bunch of cards. What your non-dominant hand is doing, which is like rolling dice or moving pieces. Your tableau, which would be that space in front of you where you have your like cards laid out. Mm-hmm. The board, which is obviously the board of a board game. The sideboard, which is, you know, like discard piles and stuff like that. And then lastly, the rule book. And I thought that was a really interesting way that I hadn't heard of it, not being from tabletop world, kind of explained as like just language around that.
Yeah, they did that thing where like you already knew all this stuff, but now you have terms to put to them.
Yeah, which was great, which is really important.
Yeah, you can like you can have all your same thoughts just way faster now, mm-hmm. because you have a way to categorize them.
Yeah. The other thing I learned is that linen textured cards are easier to shuffle.
Okay.
Because they have little pockets of air. Okay. Diz out. Okay. Okay. Mark, you want to go next?
Yeah, I'll go next. So first thing I did is I went to the Unity 6 roadmap.
Oh.
This was a pretty crowded session. And I think a lot of people were like, you know, eyes askew. Like, all right, yeah. Unity, what do you got for it? You know, they didn't talk at all about any of the runtime fee stuff. I think reporting of the time has indicated as much, which is that the people at Unity were heavily demoralized by that announcement and the fallout.
Yeah.
And also, most of them had very little to do with that monetization part of it.
Right.
So, like, they really wouldn't be capable of being the people to talk about what that means for what they're doing.
I suppose that's true.
You know, thankfully, there were no Q&A that, like, you know, picked at that scab. But I was really curious because I know that I'm not going to be using Unity 6. Mm-hmm. I'm just not. Like, yeah. There's no... We're on Dream Settler. We could upgrade for it. You know, our schedule is such that like it should be ready to go by the time we ship. But like, you know, we're happy on 2022, and happy is a Unity relative term. Everyone who knows.
Yeah.
But we're just like not like we can. They have not announced exactly how it's going to work with Unity 6. That news will come, but like we don't know it yet. So our plans are to not upgrade. So
yeah.
I was really curious because I wanted to know what we'd be missing.
Uh-huh.
Because I knew I would be excited by a bunch of stuff, but I kind of wanted to see. Yeah, a little bit, right? Because, you know, one of the things about, you know, we complain about Unity all the time, but when they do a big, you know, the major updates, like, there'll always be something in there that's like, finally.
Yeah.
You know? And that's sort of the case here. I have a ton of notes. I'm not going to go through all of these because a lot of this is just, you can find whatever blog posts they put out about this stuff.
I can do you one better, Past Mark. In fact, Unity put up this entire presentation on YouTube. It's not exactly the same thing I saw at GDC, but it's from the same slide deck. So it's pretty much one-to-one. They go through all the features. And so I'm going to cut a lot of my thoughts out of the rest of this section. I'm going to leave a couple in. But if you want to learn more about Unity 6, it's all pretty interesting. You can check it out. That's in the show notes, that YouTube link.
One area is taking all their multiplayer client server stuff and all the different services surrounding that and bring it all under one like standardized SDK, which is sort of kind of the direction they've been going, but like they seem to have a lot of confidence that like they have this thing called the like the multiplayer center. So within the editor, you just open up this panel that's like just for all the multiplayer stuff.
Hmm.
And that's, so it should be more an easier UX to actually engage and use that stuff,
okay.
Which should be very indie friendly, right? Which is all, you know, Epic's doing something similar where they offer sort of like a multiplayer backend, even if you're not using Unreal.
Yeah.
And it's really is designed so that more games can be multiplayer. And Unity's doing the same thing. And this is part of that extension. And as someone who doesn't make multiplayer games and probably won't for a good long while. A lot of this is academic to me, but it was really fascinating to think about that, especially because Unity, you never really know with them. Like, are they trying to chase AAA? Or are they trying to, like, bolster? Because, like, their audience, and especially all the people who, like, have contributed to community forums in the past 15 years, they're all indie, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, that's the core of their audience. But, like, one of the frustrations that a lot of us have always had is that they've never really known that.
Yeah.
They almost don't want to admit it. But, like, that's the core of their audience. And so, I think, but when you see some of these features and that they're doing, you're like, well, if you're even, like, a double-A studio, like, you know, like, can hire a networking team, a lot of this isn't really going to be that exciting for you. I mean, it might be, in terms of the ease of use, or it might compete with other solutions. But really, a lot of this is indie-friendly stuff. And, you know, but their messaging is still, like, ship these high-quality AAA experiences on Unity. And it's like, no. Anyway, it's all very confusing.
Sure.
Let's see, what else? Yeah, they talked a lot about dots and entity component stuff. And I'm like, yawning from the beginning of that. The big thing about dots, folks, is that it's like, if you're a Unity person and you, like, know the Unity way, dots is like admitting that the Unity way is bad and has a whole nother way of doing things. And which is like, well, then why is it in Unity?
You
know? And so they're trying to unify some things now. So they're trying to make it more game object friendly. They're like, okay, they're finally deciding, what do we need to do to make this usable for not just developers, but our developers? And I think they're getting up to that, which is sort of interesting. Oh, yeah. And the last thing that's pretty interesting is build profiles. The biggest, I think a lot of people have a problem with Unity, which is when it's time to build things. Like, there's the button to build something. But, like, if you've made enough projects in Unity, you know, that's not what you want to do. You want to have a build script. You want to have your own pipeline. You want to do this. And it's very project specific, right? Like, you have to bring all that code into the next project when you want to use that, even if you've brought had some learnings. Unity is finally having essentially a first party solution for a lot of that, where they both, you can have build profiles that are editor part of the installation. So you can use that on multiple projects. That's interesting. But then they also have just some UI for target selection. So, and they're finally updating that, where if, like, if you want to, you know, make an Xbox game, you can select Xbox. And then essentially from that, there's like a wizard to download all the crap you need for that. And presumably, they didn't say this, but presumably anything that's under an NDA or requires a component from Microsoft or from Sony or Nintendo or something, that pipeline is part of that, I'm assuming, because otherwise they wouldn't have been so proud of themselves. But the idea is essentially you choose a platform, and it isn't just changing the player target. It's actually like a whole thing of, like, downloading the libraries you need, downloading the extra SDKs for those particular platforms. Like, if you choose Android, then, like, it runs you through, you know, getting the Android SDK and all that sort of stuff. So they didn't demo it, but they showed some screenshots of what that looks like, and it's miles better. The question is like, is it a one size fits all thing that no one, that doesn't really fit anyone's use case? And it's kind of an average of everyone's use case, in which case no one will use it. And, you know, Unity's first attempt at everything is always nobody uses it. So we'll see. But and I'm not using it anyways.
So we'll never know.
So it was fascinating. I'm glad I went, because, like, I want to know. But, you know, I knew I wouldn't be swayed, and I wasn't. That's one thing. But the next step is trust. And we talked about that in our episode when we went on about it. But so I won't go into further detail. But I'm not ready to trust them with it, even if it's a reasonable price for the services they provide, which I've always thought is, like, it's pretty reasonable, you know, when you add it all together. But they didn't. It's not the best things on sliced bread, but a bunch of cool stuff. So it was pretty interesting. Then I went to the Flash Games Postmortem. Volume 2. So I went to this 7 years ago, apparently. That was when I was like, oh my God. The Flash Games Postmortem was just a talk 7 years ago that I did go to. It must have been my first GDC, I guess. Nobody double checked that.
Okay, I went and checked that. It was the first GDC that I went to for the show. And in fact, you can hear me talk about the Flash Games Postmortem Part 1 in that episode. It's episode 18 of the show. Very long time ago. Direct link for that in the show notes.
This talk was essentially what's happened since. And so I talked a lot about the preservation efforts for Flash content. A lot of the portals that have just stayed open that made Flash games, or not made, I mean, sorry, distributed Flash games, and what they've done to continue that, keep that content going. And one of the things they said, the speaker said, was that the preservation of Flash content is essentially a model for other communities looking to preserve content. And that was interesting. I never heard it phrased that way, that it's been a big success. That there's HTML emulation. There's also custom browsers out there that still allow the Flash player. And so if you do need an environment where you can play this content, it's interesting because for me as a old school Flash developer, I was never part of that Newgrounds, Congregate,
sure.
Armor Games. Like, I was never part of that,
yeah.
The web portal kind of community of developers.
Yeah.
I was an animator. And then when I started making games in Flash, I was focused on Adobe Air, targeting desktop, targeting mobile. And so it was interesting that how different that community is, and specifically how unrelated the work I did in Flash is to a lot of the culture of Flash games. And so sometimes it's interesting because I feel like I was there for that whole time.
Yeah.
I used Flash since like 2002.
Yeah.
But like, it is when people talk about the Flash game era, I had actually very little to do with that. So sure. It's actually fascinating to hear some of this stuff.
Okay.
And when you think about all the content that was done for Adobe Air, which is the packaging Flash in its own captive runtime, if you don't know, like I've been saying in recent episodes, even like, you can still put Flash on an iPhone. It's like not a problem.
Right.
Never been a problem. It's still possible today. But that's really not what they're talking about. It really is Flash on the web.
Yeah.
And that community of like hobbyist games and those groups of indies that built a career from there. And so a big part of the talk was also about all the developers who came up in that culture and then went on to do other things.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like talked about like games like Cult of the Lamb and Among Us, and, you know, sort of try to claim those development teams as part of that culture, even though those games are not made with Flash or never were.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of interesting and a little bit of like trying to square a circle, I think.
Sure.
But really cool. And then, you know, at the end is like, okay, well, we'll see you for volume 3 in 2031.
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting. Cool. But yeah, I did a bunch of other like planning for meetings this week. So those are the only two talks I went to.
Max.
I only went to one talk today and it was great. It was Game Narrative Summit Cinematics and Interactivity in Cyberpunk 2077.
Cool.
Two sides of the same coin. One mouthful of a title.
Yeah, it is. For real.
Yeah, that's why I didn't say any of my real titles.
Yeah. It was basically talking about the cutscenes in Cyberpunk, which I haven't even played yet, but it still found it very interesting, where they found that a lot of the interesting stuff you can do with cutscenes is that kind of Half-Life 2 style of people talking in like a little confined space, and it's not a cutscene, it's just...
You can like move around
in that space. Sure. And then how with their RPG setup that, like, you know, if you come into the environment with this person pissed off at you, or if you want to handle a situation with violence or non-violence, how they can reuse assets or animations to make the story play out differently and react according to your actions without doing a massive budget overhaul to sure. like animate 5 different things, you know.
Yeah,
pretty neat.
Yeah, that's cool.
There's definitely a category of talk, which is that I'm interested in this game, I want to hear more about it.
Yeah
And less about your own career development and more it's a little behind the scenes. It's fun. I think those
are always fun to go to because you can still find some aspect of it that you could use. Like,
yeah,
I'm not doing a lot of cutscenes, but that kind of thinking of how to reuse your own assets is always useful.
Mm-hmm.
And any new nugget of information is something else that could go a mile in a different context.
Yeah. Cool. We did, me and Dale did spend some time in the gardens, and we talked to a person who was hired on to this animation studio that does traditional animation, not video games, but they wanted to transition into starting to make video games. It was a really cool talk. So that'll be probably at the end of this section of the episode as well.
No, Steven, probably not. In fact, certainly not. That's another one of our interviews that's going to be on Patreon exclusively. Patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Now, did I put that up there on the Patreon instead of at the end of this episode so that Steven would be wrong? I mean, that's for you to decide.
Well, that's pretty much Monday, but then we did some stuff in the evening.
Yes.
You stopped into the... the Midwest meetup.
Yeah, it was kind of disappointing. It was a
little crowded.
Yeah, it was pretty crowded. I mean, Max, you stayed there a little longer than we did.
Just a little longer.
Oh, okay. But it basically, yeah, it was a big crowded thing, and I didn't recognize anybody. I was hoping to recognize people at this event. This was an event hosted by, I think it was for, like, the Midwest Games publisher.
And something else, I think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. Basically, it was just like a business meetup kind of event. Like, it was at the Marriott, right? So, like, it's just a... That's like the place where you do businessy things. I don't know. The vibe wasn't...
It was
awesome. Right. It wasn't like that. It was just like, it wasn't for me.
You thought it was going to do just like a bunch of people around a couple of tables chatting.
Yeah, like, it wasn't that.
Yeah.
If I wanted to get that, I would go to the gig event, which I did.
Yes.
And that was more of that.
So the Games Industry Party, it was called, hosted by the Games Industry Gathering.
Yes.
Which we're members of, which is, it started during the pandemic. Talked about it on the show before.
Yeah.
But every year they do a gig IRL event.
Yeah.
And every year Dale isn't invited.
Well, that's because Dale has not signed up for gig yet.
Yeah.
We're going to do that when you get home so that you come to the party next year.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just an informal gathering. And every year I go and I say like hi to like five people I know from this online meetup that we do every month.
Yeah.
And then like, that's it. Then I just see them at the next online meetup.
Yeah.
So like, it's fun, but like, I've stopped expecting it to be more than that.
Sure.
You know, see people in real life that I hang out with online, and I'm going to, like, hang out with them. Like, it doesn't...
Yeah.
I always kind of want there to be more going on, but really, it's just a hangout, and everyone's having a good time, and that's all it is, and that's all it needs to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just got back from that.
It's fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's more tomorrow. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, we are going to bed, and then we're going to get ready for tomorrow, but if you listen, don't have long to wait to hear about Tuesday.
Hey folks, this is Future Mark again in the what we call the bluer section in the middle of the episode. I'm going to use this time to actually tell you about what's coming up in the next couple of weeks and how we ended up putting together these GDC episodes. So the original plan, as you heard at the top of this episode, was that we were going to record each night and then edit that into one special for you. But we ended up really getting into a lot of the different topics, and so we're splitting it up into two. We also had planned to splice in some of the interviews we recorded, but it turns out we had a couple really small ones, and as I mentioned earlier in the splice-ins, I'm putting those up on Patreon, but we had two really in-depth interviews as well that we recorded at the show, and so that's going to be a third special episode, so stay tuned for the rest of this one, where we continue the first half of the week of GDC. Next week is going to be the second half of the week, and then the week after is going to be our two big interviews that we recorded in the show. And I will detail those a little bit more, probably in the bluer, next week. So you can get all hyped up for that then, instead of now, when you just have to pocket it for 2 weeks. Again, one more pitch, patreon.com/nicegamesclub for the remaining bonus material. We appreciate if you sign up for that. Otherwise, of course, you've still got 2 weeks of more GDC content. And you know what? The rest of this episode as well. That's so much stuff, folks. Anyway, I'm going to get out of your way so you can enjoy it.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify?
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Okay, welcome to... Wait a minute, this is Wednesday.
No, it's not. It's Tuesday.
Okay, we're recording on Wednesday because we decided to not record every day because...
We were tired.
No, I got home late last night. It's good news, but we'll talk about it when we get to that point.
Okay, so let's recount some Tuesday stuff.
All right, Steven, you go first. What'd you do on Tuesday?
All right, cool. So I went to a Black and Gaming event. It was like a whole side thing that wasn't part of GDC. And I went to a couple of talks. The first talk was about education in games. Specifically, actually, the way that this talk was like structured was more about like teaching students about gaming in general and like how that can be utilized to give students like better career potential in the future.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it sound a little cynical, but that's kind of what it was. It was basically like a lot of these teachers were talking about the impacts of gaming in schools and how that like can improve their overall education.
Okay.
So we're not talking like training future drone pilots.
No.
They're like general gaming skills applicable to...
Yeah, well, a lot of it was focused around gaming specifically, but I also game dev stuff.
Okay.
A little bit. That being said, there was like talks about esports. One of them was specifically talk about esports and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like the school to basketball scholarship thing kind of feeling, which I didn't particularly care for, but you know,
that's a long standing model.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess applying that, but yeah, it has its own problems.
Yeah. One of the benefits of this though is like they were trying to get like I guess they describe them as esports labs, but ultimately they're computer labs.
And yeah.
So it means they get high quality computer equipment in schools, even if that is also used for the purposes of, you know, esports stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listeners will remember when Ellen talked about the Serious Games Conference in Toronto.
Yeah.
She visited one of those labs.
Yeah.
Which was basically, she described it the same way. It's like, yeah, it's ridiculous. And there's all this RGB lighting that's, you know, ugly up the place. Uh-huh. But these are really good computers.
Yeah.
And it's used as a computer lab.
Mm-hmm. So it's got real benefit regardless of the fact.
Yeah.
I mean, basketball gives people basketball courts, which I guess gives students something to do, but you know, don't learn computer skills. So, and then I went to a second talk about innovation game design. Johnny Jennings, who I believe has been on the show before, was on the panel,
mm-hmm.
Which was cool. And it was an interesting talk. One of the people who was on the panel was also the developer of Neveryield. I think it was interesting. I was glad that I had that perspective because like the other person was like, she was on Riot, she was part of Riot Games. So it was kind of the more I've been to this conference, the more I recognize how big a divide there is between like AAA space and indie space.
Yeah.
Because like they talk about things as though everyone experiences this when really only a certain section of game developers experience this.
Mm-hmm.
And so like it was nice to have that wide range of perspectives on like innovations in game design, which was kind of vague. And even in the panel, it was kind of vague. But
I'm going to dog ear that thought because I had a very similar experience today.
Ooh,
okay. We'll get to that when we get to that.
Okay, cool. But I do appreciate like that there was Jake that the different experience or the different experiences from it. What I really wanted to ask, I didn't get a chance to ask that during the panel, is like how the heck they made the money so they could do these innovative things. They didn't answer that during the talk because I want to know, dang it. And then I didn't get a chance to go to the other talks because I got to them too late. And the reason for that was because my coworkers were here. We did some pitches and stuff for a bunch of different games.
Mm-hmm.
After those first two talks, we did a pitch with Amazon. Well, actually, we did 3 pitches for Amazon. That was the whole thing. They asked me some questions about tech things, and I answered them. And then Franny, who's been on the show before, she's like, good job, Steve. And I was like, yeah.
So what I'm learning here is that praise goes a long way.
It does for me. then we also, later in the day, talked with somebody we were hoping we could partner with, because like they're missing the kinds of stuff that we have, and we're missing the kind of stuff that they have.
Oh,
I'm trying to be vague about it because I don't remember all of the details of what I can talk about.
But you described some of it to us, off mic, and I will say that it sounds like a match made in heaven.
Yes.
Yes. So here's hoping that pans out and is as good as it sounds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it did seem like we wanted to work together in some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that capacity means is, you know, to be determined in the future. But the real exciting news, and part of the reason why I was late, is because I also pitched Sledgehammer Pride to these people. And we pitched 3 game ideas, right? Sledgehammer Pride was the headliner.
Yeah.
It was the first
one. And then, like, a bunch of other stuff, who cares?
Yeah. The other 2 games were cool ideas. The other 2 games were cool ideas, too. And the person I was talking to, he loved all 3. But then he was like, These are all great pitches. I could really see what things you bring to the table, right? But if you had to pick one that you wanted me to really like bat for, which one would it be? And then like he stepped away to go to the bathroom or something. I don't remember exactly what it was. But then everybody got together and was like, we're gonna pitch Sledgehammer Bride, right? I didn't have to say anything.
So listeners who are like, hey, what's Sledgehammer Bride? First, shame on you.
Right.
And second,
You know, we have a bunch of new listeners. I believe you've been passing out flyers.
This is gentle ripping for all the new folks.
Yeah.
Don't know that Sledgehammer Bride is a concept of Stevens.
Yeah, it's a passion.
Which everyone falls in love with when they hear it. And I believe we did a whole episode about it, as it was thinking, right?
Yes, we did. Yes.
So listeners can go back and hear Steven's thoughts on that and are sort of like bouncing around brainstorming with you. But it's a concept of yours that we in the clubhouse really believe in.
Yeah.
And it's now something that's a going concern at Future Club.
Well, I mean, it's not just me that believes in it, but Future Club believes in it too.
Yeah.
And that's what really like, oh my gosh, my heart was so full hearing that. It was just beautiful to hear. I was just, I love Future Club so much.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was late, is because we were at this dinner and it went long because we were talking and it was going very well.
Yeah.
So like it just went longer than I anticipated going. Yeah. It started at like 7 and I said I would get home at 10. I didn't get home until like almost 11.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a good sign though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was my Tuesday. Yeah. Who's next?
Okay.
Dale had a Tuesday.
Right. I sure did. Okay. My first 2 talks, Mark was there.
Yeah.
Hey. Okay. The first one was urban planning in Cyberpunk 2077.
Close enough. Well, yeah, pretty good.
Yep. Okay. Mark, what was your main takeaway from urban planning?
My main takeaway from it was like urban planning is cool.
Uh-huh.
It was very high level.
Oh, okay.
But it basically brought a lot of the sort of like because the speaker was a world designer but also had an urban planning degree.
Oh,
and so so she brought a lot of that like language to it. I don't know that she has had special insight compared to people who came up with just designing open world games in games.
Sure.
Right. But a lot of the core principles was pretty interesting. So this is kind of just me saying like it was interesting, but like not, I wouldn't say eye-opening.
Okay.
Yeah, I think.
Okay. I will go over my big takeaways. She was giving an example.
Mm-hmm.
And then she showed the city map, and I said to Mark, that's a European city, not American city. And the guy next to me on the other side laughed, and it was very funny. Because Americans make all their streets really straight and in a grid pattern, and Europeans, because they, you know.
Because they did it 600 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, 600 plus years ago.
And they had invented, you know, left or right or up or down back then.
No.
Right.
No. You know, there was no urban planning center in the city of Paris, you know? So people built things where they were, and that's how, like, you know, Europeans still think about things. So that was funny.
Side story. I'm going to waste some time on the show.
Okay.
Someone on Threads was like, I don't get how these Americans are always saying things like west of here. Like, what does that mean? Like, from the direction I'm facing? I don't get it. And, and I was like, And so I replied to him, like, I think this, just trying to be gentle, like, I think this is because we have street grids. And so when we say, like, this restaurant or whatever is west of this park,
yeah,
we kind of know what we're talking about. And they're like, oh, okay. Still don't get it.
Okay, well, all right. We tried.
No, okay, I guess.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so my main takeaways were, think of, like, your map like you think about anatomy. Like, you're not going to make a perfect anatomically correct character.
Yeah.
You're going to make it so it's represents. So, like, you know, if you're making a humanoid, it's going to have two legs and two arms and a head. They don't have to be in proportion. They don't have to work like they do. Same thing with urban planning. You're going to make everything much, probably much smaller if you're doing a game where you're running, because you don't want to be, you know, your 15-minute walk to the grocery store seemed great in real life, but if you had to do that in a game, you would put that game down and never look back.
Yeah, there's a conversation about realism. Like, when you look at, like, a cartoon character, like, you know, eyeballs are not the size of softballs, but we don't really think that's a problem when a character has eyeballs the size of softballs.
Sure.
And so it's similar to when you're designing environments, is like, you design it to feel real, not be real.
Yeah. What was particularly helpful for me is she did some white boxing or gray boxing.
Gray boxing.
Gray box examples of what it looks like to have a character run through different types of environments where, you know, everything is a little bit smaller than it would be in real life versus, you know, the size, you know, your street would be in real life.
Yeah.
The other thing that I really took away from that, which, you know, didn't occur to me, is the value of having crooked streets and not having that line of sight like an American street where it goes all the way down, because now you're starting to block out that all that extra stuff to your vanishing point, and your engine doesn't have to render all that stuff.
Yeah, it is funny because I went to a talk on Spider-Man where it was talking about like oh man, things load so fast on a PS5 now. Like, we can make Spider-Man go 10 times faster. And I was thinking about that cyberpunk talk, like, thinking about the technical restraints. But she made a second point that I thought was actually more relevant. I think the reason you have to make a street a little crooked is so you don't choke the user's PC. That's the reason you have to do it.
Yeah.
The reason you'd want to do it is that it's pretty boring to go straight down a straight street for a long time.
True. Yep.
It's better when it just kinks ever so slightly, like 5 degrees. It doesn't have to take a bend, and then suddenly you see something else, or you move the stick a little bit. It keeps the player engaged. And so I thought that was an interesting example where she levers a technical problem and then found a way to like say, but this is actually good and here's why, so you can play to that strength. Those examples, those video examples, I think that she does a lot of credit for, because not everyone does this, actually preparing demos and videos and stuff for, instead of just slides. And so I think that
That was very helpful.
Yeah, it really illustrating the concepts.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of damning the talk with faint praise, and I stand by that. But I think it's one of the more well constructed talks I've been to this year, at least.
Okay. And then we both went to a talk called "Pitching from Indie Perspectives."
Yeah.
Okay. What was your main takeaway there?
Okay, so this was a talk, not quite micro talks. It was three speakers, each giving their stories of pitching. Mm. And what was great about it is that they all had what I would describe as mildly contradictory advice.
Oh, that's good, I think.
And that's exactly, I had that exact same response, which is someone was like, hey, never use the form on the website. You, like, make a contact, DM on Twitter or whatever, when Twitter was a going concern, or like, this is the way you should do it because it just goes to spam, whatever. And then someone else was saying, like, the best way to do it is to use the forms on the website.
Uh-huh.
Because all the publishers now, that's how they do it. And that's how you make that first contact. And I personally have talked to publishers who say that is the way it works.
Yeah.
And I've talked to other people who are saying, like, yeah, send us an email. We have a form. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, there are different truths, but, like, it's interesting how all the speakers, some of them, they had kind of like, this is the, of all my experience, this is the truism I'm delivering to you.
Yeah.
And then, like, the next person is like, here's my truism. And it's like, not at all the same.
Yeah.
And that that gives you a sense of, like, the larger universe of this topic.
Yeah.
Which is a little depressing because there's, like, no checkbox or secret
solution. Yeah, it's the right answer.
But it does let you know that, like, ultimately what really matters is not all this secret code stuff.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you need a good deck, a good pitch, a good game, if you, you know, if like, if you spelled something wrong on the seventh slide, it doesn't gonna, you're not gonna fail the course.
Right.
They're not gonna throw it out.
Yeah.
It, you know, if you make mistakes, the goal of all this secret code stuff is to just make as few mistakes as possible, just to make it easy for, you know, them on the other end. But the core thing that really matters is what you're actually pitching.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. And I think publishers know that. But it, so yeah, that was my main takeaway, is like all the there was actionable stuff in it that was really valuable. But my main takeaway was like, oh, right, nothing is gospel.
Yeah.
Right.
My main takeaway from that was publishers are really interested in what the game feels like, which is not an easy thing to do.
Yeah,
so the more you can give them gifts and stylize your pitch deck slide in the same art style as you expect your game to be,
yeah,
is helpful for giving that overall feeling.
Right, because you're going to want to cut you want as few slides as possible. Like,
yeah,
publishers are like gamers. They don't want to read. And so,
yeah.
And so if, yeah, if you have a good theme in the slides that matches your style, then you have to explain your style less,
mm-hmm,
either in text or in other imagery. And then you can save that imagery for other things that shows mechanics that you couldn't easily describe in text.
Right.
And then now you've got a little bit of budget for text that you can use for budget and team composition and the things you have to do.
Right.
But they're not, by that point, the person you're pitching to is not exhausted from all the text you've already given.
Yeah.
Because you've delivered a more holistic sort of experience. So I also found that very valuable.
The other thing that I wrote down is always ask if they have any feedback on the pitch or feedback on the game, and then ask these questions, which are, what does the signing process look like? Gives you a timeline for, like, if it's going to take, you know, a year to like fully go through that, if you should hear back within a few weeks, kind of like an interview. What are your standard deal terms? And lastly, what is your publishing / investment strategy? Which I thought was an interesting question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the speakers talked about, to a point you just said, about the standard deal terms. This has become more and more common because there are more and more publishers now.
Mm-hmm.
It's become common for publishers to say, we just have this one contract we give for everyone. And one of the speakers was like, don't let them tell that to you. Still negotiate. I think that's one of those truisms that maybe not be as true as that person is saying.
Sure.
But one of the examples they used was one that a lot of people are aware of, which is Raw Fury, which I think a couple of years ago they put out their standard contract.
Oh, yeah.
For people to review.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time thinking, like, these are bad terms.
Mm.
It was like 50-50 split.
Yeah.
And it's like Raw Fury is, you know, they're a company to believe in.
Right.
Like, they pick good games, they sell them well, they support their developers.
Yeah.
But like 50-50, yeah, like, I mean, maybe it's from my perspective as a developer, but like, there are very few. Raw Fury is not big enough to ask for 50-50, I'll be frank.
Yeah.
And so I remember having that opinion and thinking, like, am I alone in that thought? And I'm talking to someone from there,
mm-hmm,
and trying to explain, like, this. Actually, if this is the non-negotiable deal terms, I think you might be turning people off. Like, you know, or this is giving a lot of people an impression that this is standard. And I think that's actually harmful to the indie community.
Mm-hmm.
But I also felt like that was just my assessment. I hadn't seen enough contracts to know.
Sure.
Just felt bad to me.
Yeah.
And so it was nice to hear the person in this talk say, these are bad terms. So I felt a little validated there. Now, that's just two people's reactions.
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, I also haven't seen that many contracts, but that does sound like bad terms to me.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 50-50 can work if a publisher can promise you a lot.
Yeah.
If they can give you a really big budget,
yeah,
or their track record of success is so high, mm-hmm, that you know their marketing budget is big enough that, like, your game will survive, you know, they can money their way to at least a good result,
yeah,
for sales for you. And then that 50-50 could be worth it. Or your advance is so big that that's your payday.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but that's not Raw Fury to me.
Yeah.
And so it's not that there's no deal like that you should take. But so it was nice to hear that. And then that same speaker gave a lot of different examples of different types of terms, and then also talked about their negotiations and how what they changed. And so that was pretty good actual stuff, I thought.
Cool. Dale, you went to more talks. I asked one.
I went to one more talk.
Okay.
Which was branching on a budget with Nessa. I knew who she was ahead of time.
Oh, that's right. We know Nessa from Gig. She's a friend of ours.
Yeah. Well, she gave a very good talk.
Yeah, Nessa's great.
This is what I got. Okay, and this is a narrative design. She's a writer. And what I took away from that is she loved Twine. She thinks it's the best.
Twine, oh.
Yes. And, you know, as not being in that space, I found this very helpful to think about that there's, you know, you may have branching, you may have dialogue options, but they don't always branch, or they may branch out like with the other player's response, but come back pretty quickly. And that the more you like branch out, the less, you know, like the more you have to write, and like it can quickly expand.
Yeah.
And so you want to think about the options as three pillars of choice, because they can provide consequences. So those are the branches that actually end up in branches. They can help define your character. So there may be three different ways of saying, yes, I'm excited to help. Yes, I can. I have feel responsible to help. Or, yeah, I'm doing this reluctantly, which can really help the player start to feel connected to that character. And then lastly, theme. So choices that reinforce the theme. So
oh, like, sure, yeah.
So like the pros of this kind of things are, you know, it really helps you push those themes from the perspective of your game. And then the cons are, if you do it, overdo it, it can come across as preachy, and then it can flounder if it's not supported.
That sounds like moral choices in I don't know.
So it was a very good talk.
Cool.
I really enjoyed it. And like kind of thinking about what, like all those choices and how they support things. And so like, if you have more thematic choices and character definition choices, you end up, your scope is pretty focused with few endings. But, you know, if you have more identity or character definition choices and consequential choices, you end up with, really more of a player-focused game. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah,
cool. And then I came home and took a nap. Okay.
Nice.
Bart, what did you do that I wasn't with you on Tuesday?
So I went to a couple of the talks, and I had some meetings on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the only one I really want to talk about that we didn't already talk about that we went to together is one about the Steam Secrets Nobody Tells You.
Oh, boy. Oh,
which is a real clickbaity title.
Yeah, it is.
But, like, you know...
I clicked on it.
Yeah. I think that I am still attracted to like the give me 50 tips.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Because like then I can write them down and then I know them.
Yeah.
And like, you know, there's the two types of talks that are wildly in the different. I love the real conceptual, this is a philosophical approach to game design kind of talk.
Yeah.
That I'm all about. And then I'm also like the get out your, you know,
tell me what to do.
Take a picture of these three slides.
Yeah.
Here's some literal facts you could know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also am sort of curious because, like, I would say I'm famously anti-Steam.
Yeah. That's pretty accurate.
I think Steam is the worst. I think it's bad for games. I think it's bad for gamers. I think it's bad for gaming. I think it's bad, especially bad for developers.
Yep.
But it's the world we live in. So I was curious as to, like, what, you know, is there a collection of information to know that would make me feel like, oh, this is how Steam works, and it makes more sense to me now.
Sure.
Right? I was kind of like curious about that.
Yeah. Did you come away with that?
Not especially.
Okay. But,
and I'm not really going to go into all the tips, but a lot of the main thrust of the talk was this notion of like, you need to make Steam earn its 30%.
Ah.
And so this is the kind of where it like sort of made it makes me feel a little bit like I sort of understand where it's going, is that, you know, Steam's 30% is criminal to me in a way that like Nintendo's 30% isn't, right?
Sure.
Because Nintendo provides the API and the hardware to make Switch games, right?
Yeah.
Now, that said, your game pretty much runs the same, you know, it does on Switch, it does on other hardware. So it's hard to feel the benefit of that.
Yeah.
Steam has an API,
yep,
but it's very little. Like Valve provides very little product
right
for you as a developer.
Yeah.
All they provide is the storefront.
Yeah.
And so if you put your game on there, like, you know, the hosting costs of your game and the bandwidth of its downloads are nowhere near worth that 30%. And so it did make a little more sense to me in the way he described it, because he says the way you make Steam earn that 30% is you ask them for things. And one of the things he was saying is like Steam is actually curated. Like it's sort of, Steam is famously a lazy company. They try to automate as much as possible. They have so much data, and you kind of can't blame them in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, they should use all that money to hire more people, but mm-hmm. that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, you know, things like getting part of as part of festivals or getting part of daily deals or all the sort of like, you know, things you have to game to like make your way and separate yourself from the rest of the pack on Steam, and it's very logical. It's like you have to just put in the work to like literally bug someone at Steam,
yeah,
to help your game out.
Oh.
And that feels kind of silly. And there are certain things that like Steam will just not reply to you for, depending on what your game is. Mm-hmm. And there's this notion that the speaker described of real Steam, which is like the top 5% of games, which is kind of all people really see.
Yeah.
And that is heavily curated in terms of how it's structured.
Right.
There was some pretty good information about like how to game the popular and upcoming, if I'm saying that right, that listing.
Yeah.
That he'd sort of used a metaphor describing like all games go through that list, like every game.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of little tricks about how it works, because like it's down to the minute of release. So like, so you kind of want to have, like, there's certain times of days you want to like have your game release.
Sure.
Just to literally be on that list for 30 more minutes.
Yeah.
And that depresses me to no end. That's the level we're at.
Yeah.
But you know, that's real actionable information, mm-hmm. right? And then the other thing that is really interesting, and another example of how Steam is ridiculous, is that listing is based on your, post, this is when I'm going to release this game, which is some metadata you put on your Steam store page. Yeah. You don't have to publish it when you say you're going to, right?
Yeah.
But that's the number they use the value they use, because they have no, you know, they don't know when you're really going to do it.
Right.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
What happens then is the moment that minute passes, that's when you go off the list or of upcoming.
Yeah.
But you don't go on the new list of new and notable until you actually publish the game. Which is like, of course that's true. Like, yeah. If you're designing the system scratch, that's a logical assumption to make.
Right.
It's not new because it's not available.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
But it's no longer on the upcoming because your release date is passed.
Yeah.
So like you cannot waste a second. You have to press that button.
Oh.
And which is like amazing to me.
Yeah.
There isn't, I mean, I don't have the solution other than like just stay on upcoming, or maybe Steam could more, you know, rigorously enforce those releases.
Yeah.
Or you could, you know, before you're allowed on the upcoming, because it's a very short list of things coming up very shortly,
right.
Maybe you have to automate when the release happens.
Yeah.
But like that also introduces some trouble, but then might encourage developers to get their crap together a week before their launch,
yeah.
rather than upload a build and then hit the button, which is what a lot of indie developers do.
Yeah.
So like there's a lot of systemic things that are broken down as a result of the system, but it's nice to know how it works. Mm. And so I definitely came away feeling no greater love for Steam as a product or Valve as a company,
yeah.
But understanding a little bit more of like how they got into this mess,
okay.
in a sense,
yeah.
And the kind of things that's not publicized anywhere. It's not hard to figure out these things, but yeah. Like where do you go to find it?
Yeah.
And then for everyone out there wondering how to leverage this stuff without me redoing this whole talk, the number one piece of advice is there's a Steamworks support. That's where you ask. It's the one place you interact with Steam, rather than in a lot of companies, it's actually a lot more difficult. You don't know who to contact. You need somebody's email, or there's a form on a website or on that website.
True.
With Valve, actually, or with Steam, it's actually, there is one place you go for all your requests about literally everything. So that's like, well, that's good. That was finally a piece of good news about actually leveraging that system.
Cool.
So, that was interesting. And like I said, it had a bunch of like actual information and not a lot of opinions. Like, this is just how it works. And then, you know, he hedged where he knew he had to. Like, things can always change. Valve's capricious. They make changes for no reasons all the time. So who knows what this will look like in a year. But it was good. It was good. It was a topic I didn't like, but like, I'm glad I went.
Sure.
Yeah. That was my Tuesday.
Cool.
Hey, folks. Future Mark here with the final message of the program. Now you may be wondering, hey, that was just Tuesday. There's like three more days left in the conference. Oh, that's because we had too much for one episode. So the rest of the week is going to be in part two, which is going to be out next week. And then part three is going to contain a couple of long form interviews that we did at the show. And I'll tease some more details about that as Future Mark next week. Now, last minute surprise here. If you can't wait, if you're like, hey, what's with this cliffhanger here in the middle of the week of GDC? Well, you can actually listen to part two right now On Patreon. That's right. We've never done this before, and we may not do it again, but the episode is all edited, so rather than just make our most loyal listeners wait a week, we're just going to give it to them now. And when I say most loyal listeners, that means the folks who are already patrons, but it also could mean you right now. Patreon.com/NiceGamesClub and sign up at any level. Go ahead and check that out now if you can't wait. And you may also be interested to know that next week's episode is quite a bit longer than this one is. And also, we cut a lot out of it. Rather than throw that stuff away, we actually put that up on the Patreon as well. So a couple of short interviews from early in the week, some stuff that wouldn't fit in next week's episode, and next week's episode itself is up on Patreon right now. So I hope you join us there. If not, we'll see you next week for part two, documenting the second half of the conference. All right, I'm out, but you're going to hear the outro and maybe a little funny at the end. You know how we do these things. All right.
That's our show. For show notes and links, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources. Oh, yeah, Dale, you're right here.
Yeah.
What do you post about, Dale?
Whatever the heck I want.
Okay, fair enough. Mostly it's cats. Like, this one is sounds of cats climbing walls. That's what I put on here. She likes cats. Reply on the various platforms or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. And maybe the exclusive GDC content?
We'll see.
Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. If you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Game is most likely going to be a success.
Yeah.
Please edit that so I sound much more smart.
Much more smart.
That's right.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.